Well, we have two parts in our lesson tonight. I want to finish up. We are going to finish up City of David, finish it up, done. Although I've enjoyed it, it's always been good for me to go through it. I've never gone through it as much detail as I have this time. And what you do is look for trouble with your position and fix it if you have some. And then I want to do the last half of the lesson, basically, on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the Catholic, Coptic, Armenian version of, not the version of, but the place where they think Christ not only was crucified, but buried and was resurrected. So that's a very interesting place to go. People probably don't often want to go there, but you need to go there. It's historic. So we'll give you a little picture or peek into it tonight. All right, so let's finish up here on this stuff on the City of David. My statement is, if you find the City of David, you locate the Solomon's Temple. I think they're connected. So there is near to universal confusion about the location of the Jewish temple. And I say again that it's no big deal to me where the temple is. The temple we serve is actually one made without hands. It dwells in heaven. But it's a historic issue. And I always am encouraged to follow truth because you never know where it'll lead you, right? So you discover other things sometimes than you intend to. Okay, so I'm not hung up on the temple location. I want you to know that. But I think it's a worthwhile study. Okay, I think the temple location has been most placed by virtually everyone, whether the Jew or Gentile, professional or amateur, anyone. So much invested in the wrong location that nations have or are prepared to go to war over the site. Since this is so widely held, a thinking person must inquire, why is the Harem el-Sharif, which is what the Temple Mount is called, the Harem el-Sharif, whatever that means in Aramaic, is the Temple Mount, and it's generally considered the accepted place. Why is that so? What is the evidence for the temple having been there? This is not a weird question in light of what Jesus predicted about the temple when he said there will be not one stone left on the other. It would all be destroyed, including the foundation, by the way. So this question is always answered in the same way, and the answer is the Jews would never lose track of the temple site. And with our argument, we kind of are done because it's an argument now from silence, because how can I prove that that's not true because that's what they say is true? So I have to find somebody from the dead that said, no, we know where it is. Because we saw it. We don't have anybody like that. So as we noted, the argument is hard to refute because it has plausibility. Well, it'd be reasonable with the attachments that the Jews have for the Temple Mount. They never would have lost track of its site. But in our last session, we discovered that the Jews had indeed lost track of the whole City of David. According to the spokesman from the City of David outreach coordinator, she said that the city was lost for 2,000 years. Now that the City of David has been discovered from 1867, now I got to convince you that it was lost. Because everybody knows it's not lost, but if you go back in history, it was lost. All right, so I thought it was kind of ironic, you know, got to explain everything, because now we're used to it not being lost, and I said, well, there was lost. No, it wasn't lost. Yes, it was lost. She said it was lost. I take her word for it. And you look at old maps, it is lost, was lost. But when the City of David was found, interestingly, back in 1867 up to current day, the temple did not return to Zion because it's so entrenched in the convictions. So is not losing the whole city more incredible than losing the temple? It is reasonable that the City of David and the temple must be in the same proximity. If you lose one, you lose them both. That would explain that. So we must not forget that the location of the temple was determined at the time of David, not at the time of Jesus or the rebuilding of it. It was the beginning of the monarchy. Actually, David's reign, not Saul's reign. So we just say roughly 1000 BC. At that time, there was no temple mound. There was no temple. There was only a small thrashing floor in a Jebusite city called Jebus, which David took. It was on that spot that God told David to build an altar, not a temple. Solomon built a temple. Now, it is our contention that the items mentioned in the Bible that are associated with the temple, which are the threshing floor, the palace of David, the temple servant's house, the Watergate, the Gihon Spring are all in close proximity to each other because the Bible talks about them in that way. Now, if this is a reasonable hypothesis, then we have most likely determined that the location of the temple, determined the location of the temple, because it's got to be next to one of those or all of those. Now, don't get the standard of proof here too high here. I'm not looking for proof that would be convincing to a jury in a court of law. We're not talking about that. We're just looking for a probable location. Because even when you find a probable location, you're still not going to be able to say it was right here. You're not going to be able to do that because it was destroyed. So don't get your standard too high. However, what may be reasonable hypothesis for some may fall short for others. So if only the Bible would say things like, well, the palace of David was 30 feet from the temple, or it was within arm's reach, or it was within a strata, you know, some measurement, then we'd say, well, we know exactly where it was, but we don't have those kind of words to describe it. No distances are given. We have no words like next to or associated with, and we would say from our point of view that would help. But I say, is this not to be expected if the entities are associated in the proximity of the temple? And everybody knows where they are. You don't have to say the relationship. So it is possible to argue that the threshing hole could be some quarter of a mile away. I guess you could argue, you know, they have always the sophomoric argument. So, well, how can you prove it's not there? You know, some could argue that fourth or third of the mile away from David's house outside the city. Well, perhaps. But is it not more plausible that the threshing floor be near David's house, since another place is not mentioned, or distance is not mentioned? So it's assumed it's got to be next to it. When the prophet talks to David about buying the threshing floor, it just says that David went up to the threshing floor and talk to Ornan. All right, so he doesn't say anything about it, so you assume it's got to be close by. Since the threshing hole is not mentioned, it would be safe to assume that the author meant no substantial change in location. Further, it would be odd that the temple be built outside the city at some distance. We'd expect the temple would need be next to the administrative offices of the king. Both have the need for protection granted by the walls and the city and its supporting defenses, city services, we might say. Think that'd be all together, not some off in the distance spot. Now, we talked about this last week. After David captured the city, he was honored by the king of Lebanon with a personal house or a palace. Then the prophet told David to buy the threshing floor from the Jebusite for an altar. Now, David intended to build a temple, but the Lord said that his son Solomon should do that on the site of the threshing floor. And Solomon was anointed king at the spring of Gihon, near where the official seals have been found. The bulle were found from the first temple period, and it was in this vicinity of the spring up the hill to the house of a temple official who kept legal documents, which were destroyed in 586. In other words, you start from the top of the hill where the temple was, where the palace would have been, the official's house down near the Gihon Spring, all that sort of all fell together. And it's in this house on this road down to the spring is where these seals were found. And I'll show you that again. In fact, you found Hezekiah's name. That's a new one I didn't know. Now, I've got three panels. I'm not going to go through them because it's all Bible verses about the usage of the word David, city of David, my holy mountain, Jerusalem, dwelling in mountains. That's God's doing all of this. And it by itself doesn't prove anything, but it does show how often these words are associated together without any comment. Okay? So I'm still going to go on that track that they are close together. They're not scattered out like some suburban sprawl. Now, another one that's really pretty clear, when Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up from the city, it's a Bible verse in 2 Chronicles 8, you know, Solomon had a lot of wives, they were political wives, and he didn't live with all of them. It'd be pretty tough. 2 Chronicles 8:11 says this, when Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up from the city after the temple was built, up from the city of David to the house which he had built for her, and he said, my wife shall not dwell in the house of David, king of Israel. Why? Because the places are holy where the ark of the Lord has entered. So she can't be close to the temple. Not a quarter mile away. In fact, that's about where she went. In fact, I think there's a place, I think it's on the, I'm not sure. I was going to say, I thought it was on the ridge of Mount Moriah where that was, but I didn't have time to look it up. So it's out of this range is where she lives. In fact, they have found Egyptian artifacts, and they think that's where that house was. So these kind of things, you know, how they do that. So we have a very clear statement here that she couldn't live next to the temple where Solomon was living. Pretty strong argument that they're together. Now, the threshing floor, and just want to pick this up, that the Lord, angel of the Lord said to David to build a threshing floor and an altar to the Lord, and I just have a drawing here, that rough drawing of the, we have the Acra here, and we have the opal here. It should be O-P-H-E-L. And then the Milo in between, which the Milo means the fill, so this has been filled in. And when it's filled in, then David built his house here, and then up on this spot would have been the temple. Okay, and then Ophel would have been the place, we talk later about the service of the temple would have lived, they would have been living on the Ophel. So they're very, very nicely confined to a spot, and down here is the Gihon Spring, which had been brought water up to the temple. Whoops, I went to the wrong place, went to the temple this way. And Solomon built his house on Mount Moriah on the threshing floor of the Jebusite. It's connected to the house of David and the threshing floor, the future temple site. They were close to each other and cannot be a quarter mile away in an unidentified location. If they'd be somewhere else, it would have said, the text would have said, it was not here, but it was over there. Since it doesn't say it's over there, you assume it's here. Now, maybe that doesn't convince you, but it helps me a lot. All right. Now, Nehemiah's time. I'm looking for evidence here where this all happens. Nehemiah's time, they were close to, the builders built the walls where they were living, where they lived, right? And the point of that was, if you repaired the wall where you lived, you'd probably do a better job than if you built the wall where somebody else lived. And so so Nehemiah was smart enough to have you build your own wall. A little self-interest there. So the repairs are made close to where the workers lived. And everybody got involved. Even the temple servants, they're rebuilding. They have rebuilt the temple by now. Now they're rebuilding the walls, remember? So we're around 444 B.C. The temple was built, finished in 515, about 100 years, not quite, before. But the walls are needing to be rebuilt. That's Nehemiah's job. So there are temple servants serving. The temple servants living in the Ophel here to the north in front of the water gate. Here's the water gate down here. Made repairs as far as the front of the water gate. Did I read that? I did read that. Toward the east, which is this towards us, towards you, east and the projecting wall. That projecting wall apparently came out to protect the water gate or the spring. So the temple servants living, now this is where they worked, living in the Ophel, made repairs as far as the front of the water gate towards the east and the projecting tower. So they weren't a quarter mile away coming down here to work on the wall. They were working in their vicinity. Another argument that where they lived, they would live next to the temple, and the temple is next to the spring. All right? That's what I'm saying. Now, again, we're not looking at, we can't find these, and it was right next to the temple. We're not looking for those kind of things, that they don't exist, because everybody knows where they were. Now, we're trying to figure it out. Oh, then we have one more, two more. The temple was a place where they go to get safety from their enemies. So it's not a good place to go if it's outside the wall. You know, to go in the temple, it was this place of safety, says Nehemiah 6:10. And when Ezra read the law to them, they read that at the Gihon Spring. Why at the Gihon Spring? Because that is the center of worship. Temple's right up here. People in the Kidron Valley, where they probably could hear. Not up a quarter mile up on the hill. All right. So Ezra read the law in front of the water gate. Nehemiah verses chapter 8, verse 1 and 16. Now, when the Nehemiah dedicates the walls, they had singers. They had two groups, two choirs. And the first choir started out at the refuse gate. We call it the dung gate. Now remember, these don't correspond with the gates that we have today. The dung gate, a totally different wall, different place. But it was down here where the Hinnom Valley comes down this way, the refuse gate. All right, so it said at the Fountain Gate, which is down here. Fountain Gate would be the water that comes down from the Galen Spring, and some of it dumps into this Pool of Siloam. Some of it was used to water the valley along the Kidron Valley here. All right, so the Fountain Gate is where the water runs out at the bottom. So at the Fountain Gate, they went directly up the steps of the City of David by the stairway of the wall. So I imagine that stairway followed the wall on up. By the stairway on the wall above the house of David, which is where it's going, and I added the word which is near. You got to read it to smooth it out. The house of David to the water gate on the east. So which is near the water gate on the east, which makes sense. So the water gate would have been on the east side here. So that exactly, at least that's what I think it's saying. And that would argue that they would have had to walk all the way up here from this point on, yet another quarter mile up here to the Temple Mount, if that's really where it is. All right. Now that isn't conclusive either. None of these are, but you start building a case with that can't, you know, it makes sense that this would be the way it is. All right, so Nehemiah was locating the singing choirs at the time of the dedication of the walls. And the other groups north in the singing kind of must have been like an antiphonal choir. And by the way, if you'd have these choirs singing at this point and they'd be a quarter mile away, I don't know for sure you'd hear them or not. But anyway, made that PA systems. Okay, now we did spend some time on the bulla last week. I'll show you this. This is extant. You can see it yet today. This says this is the house of the bulla. So somewhere in here, I can't exactly see where the arrow points. It's where these bulla were found. I think they found 51 of them. And a lot of them have Hebrew writing on them. In fact, I found this one today, or not found it, found the information about it, that supports the city of David there. The temple would logically be built near or at the core of the city, the administrative quarters. A water source so essential to the operation of the altar is conveniently right at hand, near the location of the discovery of the bulla. Now, this is the discovery of Hezekiah, probably one of the greatest kings of Israel outside of David. Maybe Solomon, I don't know. He did a great job. He got rid of a lot of idol worship, expanded the city, and so forth. And then this is his, then I watched a video on this. They dispel all this out. This dispels out his name as king. And I see it's interesting. He's got an insect kind of as a, what do you call it, logo. So Hezekiah's bulla found in the place near David's palace, which of course would later on become Hezekiah's house. Again, now we're third of a mile away from where you'd expect it to be, but you know, the discovery of the city of David by this Maser lady have discovered these things, and now all of a sudden we think they have found where the palace was. And if wherever the palace is, then the rest has got to go with it. So I have shown you five items mentioned must be in the same or near proximity to each other. We have the Zion, the city of David, the holy mountain, the house of David, the threshing floor, the Galen Spring, and the temple servants. They're mentioned together as if they're in the same place. So if one of these elements can be located, then the others associated with have to be there too. Okay? I think you understand the logic at least. Now, this is a good sketch, approximation of the city of David, although the threshing floor, they have way up here. See, this is the threshing floor where the temple will someday be built. Now, I think that they've got this pretty good here, and this would be, I'd call this the temple, and this would be the house of David in here. And this, of course, before this was cut down, this would have been higher up here, and then come on down. And here's the Gihon Spring. These little towers over here show that protects the spring. And so from here to here is the distance to the temple. So that's my argument. There would have been a north wall that would have come around this north side, but it wouldn't have been way out here, which is the way it's grotesquely drawn like that. Okay, I didn't mention much about Hezekiah's tunnel. I won't tonight either, but it's kind of a well-known tunnel. It was built during the Assyrian siege about 721 B.C., and Hezekiah built a tunnel. He actually covered it up totally so that they couldn't get to it and rerouted the water so it came back this way to the Pool of Siloam, and this became a city that could last years under siege. And even though Sennacherib, who besiege the city, acted like he took it. He never did. I mean, in his annals, they say he took the city. But the Bible says that was 150,000 were wiped out overnight on the hills as they were waiting to attack. Now, that's not mentioned in Sennacherib's annals, but we know the Bible records that. That's why they never came into the city, because they were destroyed. And I noticed down here they call an Enrogel spring. It's really not a spring. It's a well. So I've told you there's no spring within 5 miles. So when you see something like that, you say, well, there's another spring. Well, it really isn't. It's really a well, a place where water was kept, not a spring. Okay, so we have Hezekiah's tunnel. It also argues that this is the city of David. No one argues about that anymore because Hezekiah would have dug it in the city of David. So again, another evidence that we're on the right track. Okay, Josephus records. You love him or you hate him. It just depends on where you are. I've gotten to love him. I generally find him to be reliable. What can I check? But, you know, I have one today that has, and I brought one up to you the other day, that's, well, how can that be? But I can show you how it can be. So my faith is back in, my trust is back in Josephus' record again. Now, Pete, I exaggerated so you can see it, right? So this little hill isn't quite that steep, right? But get you the idea. Now, the temple, as I said, Josephus says, I've already have said, was built up on a strong hill. I guess that would be called a high hill or obvious steep-sided hill. And I'll show you this before. Now, I'll go to the next picture. So this is a steep hill, and this is his temple up here, right? Kind of teetering there. So at first, the plain at the top was hardly sufficient, that is, that's small, for the holy house, and the altar for the ground about it was very uneven, like a precipice. So that's what I'm trying to show you here. And I put the temple on it. It's become not a very stable place. So Solomon's going to do something about it. Well, first of all, David. Now, when you build a temple, when King Solomon, who was the person that built the temple, had built a wall on it on the east side, the Kidron Valley side, there was then added one cloister colonnade, founded on a bank cast up for it. And on the other parts, the holy house stood naked. Now, I don't know exactly how the cluster worked, but, you know, they would have these rows of columns, and you put a platform on top of it. Could have been on the side or been on top. I don't know. It doesn't seem to change anything here, but he does talk about a cloistered side. So the other side stood kind of naked, so this is being done in stages. It goes on to say, but in future ages, after Solomon did the east side, the people added new banks, and the hill became a larger plain. Now, I think they added on both sides. Okay? Then they broke down the wall on the north side. I just showed you that here before. This one here. They broke down the hill on the north, a wall on the north side, and what they've actually did, they just pushed it out and made the city bigger. That's what he's saying. And then they broke down the wall on the north side and took in as much of the space as sufficed afterward for the compass of the entire temple. So we had something totally around it. Now here was the hard part to swallow. So the lowest part of this was erected to the height of 300 cubits, is 450 feet. And in some places, more. Remember, I told you Capitol is 400 feet high and the Giza is 430. So, you know, we're talking about some elevation here. Yet the entire depth of the foundation, in some places more, yet did not the entire depth of the foundations appear. In other words, some of this wall was below grade, which would make sense. Maybe go down to bedrock. For they brought earth and filled up the valleys, which I don't show here, but they could have filled the valley, so the foundation would have been down here. Maybe that's bedrock. As being desirous to make them a level with the narrow streets of a city. So they just want to flatten it out. We do the same thing today. We take the hills down and put them in a valley and levels it off, especially so, you know, like interstate roads where they really minimize the valleys and the hills. Okay, now this is a complicated picture, so I'm not going to tell you everything about it, but it is a cross-section, that one, same one. Now, I'll do some of this. Okay, this is the far that you can't see it, the far hill we call New Zion. That's this one up here. Oh, I got to first pick one. Okay, this is the Zion, the far hill. And if we go to the city, to David's tomb, that's where we go. It's high up like that. Then we have the Temple Mount, which is here, And then we have the city of David now is at this level, and it used to be like this. That's it, it's been cut down. Okay. Now, what I want to show you here is that if you take the Temple Mount, call it, and go straight out to the south, which I have done here, you get out here to the end of the city of David or somewhere along here, you get, this is 450 feet. Now, it seems like it's kind of impossible to have something that big, but then we are always awed at how these old-timers could build these big structures. Giza, for an example. Someday I'm going to study that. I don't know how. You know, they had to put down a rock every 20 seconds for 20 years for that to be done. Every 20 seconds? There's so many rocks on that thing. Anyway, some of these things just boggles my mind. Okay, what I'm telling you now is that Josephus says that's 450 feet from here to there. And if I could extend this out, I've got an elevation to do that. So I would say Josephus may be on to something. Now let's look at some more pictures. This is about standing where the lady told us that the city of David was lost for 2,000 years. That's about where this is taken. And I just took a line and drew it out straight as I could figure, kind of freehanded it, out to the Kidron Valley and show you an elevation here. Now this isn't 400 feet, but we're not at the top of things either. So all this would have been filled in. Been retaining walls, maybe not in one jump, could jump back, you know, steps like we have it. It could have been. And then you have, by the time you're all done, the distance is 450 feet, according to Josephus. Okay, that's one. And we saw this last week, how today it looks differently, but those, you know, today is like modern days. 1915, it just looks flat. They're farming it. But what you don't see is the valley that's here that's really quite deep. You can't see it. I can't see that. So I did the same thing with this picture and wrote out a line of the temple and kept it straight. And I just kept going like that. See, and then I looked at, well, now what do I have here? Well, then you get out here in the Kidron Valley, we'd have quite an elevation again. So all I'm saying is what Josephus says may be right. Okay, so the city appears as level as David did for his purposes in his palaces, as Solomon did for the temple. The area shown is flat and farmable, yet today there is a steep drop-off on the east side, which I showed you, which uncovers the rubble of the Jebusite city. So you just keep pushing the dirt over, and pretty soon you got stuff that's underneath there that is lost to the naked eye until it's dug up, which has been done. Now, the remarkable thing of this, if you have not been there, is below this surface, you're looking at another 20 or 30 feet lower, there's a whole civilization down there. And that's what they're excavating in the city of David. I'll show you a picture of that. So it's hard to imagine until you've seen it. And when you see it, you don't believe it. So this is the same idea in today. I think these could, I can't tell you when they hit bottom here. And obviously, we're not in the bottom of the Kidron Valley here. So I guess I'm saying the temple, where it was located, and the size of Josephus says, would have been huge. Well, it was considered probably like one of the 10 wonders of the world. And, you know, it was made of this white limestone or white marble, and it glistened with the gold. I mean, it was absolutely spectacular, they say. Okay, now we have the facts of the city of David. All right, now here is a picture of underground. I just showed you what's upstairs. This is below. And you said they put a whole ceiling in there with iron beams and joists and purlins. And I don't know how they do this without those guys upstairs not messing up their plumbing. And they're living up there. And so they come underneath here and find this. And what you're looking at is basically the foundation house of the Palace of David. Now, when we're going to go back this year, we're going to be 4 days after everybody else goes home. And I can go with a few people and just look at these places. I hope I can make some sense out of this. And when I do, maybe I can come back and tell you about it. But anyway, some have asked about who all has dug here. Charles Warren was the first one, 1860. Not the first, but one we remember. Charles Warren, the Warren Shaft and all that kind of stuff. Warren Arches and all that kind of stuff. We know about him. Catherine Kenyon's been around a long time. She dug around in the 50s in Jericho and in the 60s in Jerusalem. And she was what you call a minimalist. She didn't believe the Bible. In fact, if she did any discovery, she was trying to prove the Bible wrong. So, but she did dig here. And then we have a couple others. The one that's really important is Elot Mazer. It's the lady daughter of the other Mazer who dug here for years. So she's the one that discovered the city of David, found some of these bullae, and pretty well iced the cake that this was really the temple of David, or palace of David, although some don't agree with it. So where is that location? We see it right here. Whoops, I've got to go back here. So we go back here. This is where this is, and the Gihon Spring is down here. Move. Gihon Spring is down here, right here. Okay. Now I'm going to show you these quickly, trying to explain it. This is what you can actually see today, what you see in the drawing here. This is what you can see today. This is in the drawing. In the house that's in front of it, this is where the bullae were found. There's the bullae. And the part of these columns exist. If you look, not in this picture, but in the picture that comes up, these still stand there, or they've been rebuilt, whatever. This is part of Nehemiah's wall up here. And this would have been part of who knows what, and is still extant. All right, but it's right below where the temple would have been. This is the reconstruction of the house. It's just turned. I'm not going to explain all this to you, but this is what you see when you're there. The stepstone house, here are your columns I talked about. So the bullae would have been down in here, been discovered. I am kind of hurrying. And we have here the temple reconstructed, and here would be our 450-foot high point that Josephus would have talked about. Because he does say that the wall went out into the bottom of the Kidron Valley, and it went lower than the valley bottom, the foundations would have. Okay, so this would be what we see here now is the temple, and at the Temple Mount, but this is the quarters for the 10th Legion, an army facility, and you can see how they would need that kind of space, and why would the Romans ever destroy their own base anyway? So that's why it still stands, even after the destruction of Jerusalem. This is the tower house. The Gihon Spring would have been, remember, it came up from below. It didn't come out from the side of the mountain, so it'd come up, and these would be tanks that would have held water, and they would use the water for irrigating and so forth. There are two tanks here, two places. And we talked about this, so I question temple up here. I don't think so. At least that's my conviction. And again, we go back to what looks like is pretty good here. Palace is here. The temple would have been here. And I'd say this is the cut-down version of the mountain that's now gone. So we're living down here now in the Gihon Spring here. And again, the distance to the temple would have been relatively short. We've seen this before, same thing. Just a picture of that, what you see today. This is kind of old picture because it hasn't been developed like it is today where tourists can spend their money. All right. Good. I got done with that. Now, I was hoping about a half hour. Now I want to talk to you about the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. When you go there, some people don't want to go there necessarily because it isn't Catholic totally, because there are five groups that actually share the space, but it has a Catholic feeling to it because it's very a ritual in its appearance, and it has a lot of glitz and glamour and candles and suspicion with it, attached with it. But it's historic. You got to go there. In fact, when we were there last time between the two groups, Juan and I went through it and took our time to look at all that, and that's where I got some of these extra pictures that I ordinarily don't get, because usually when you're there, you're kind of rushing to get out of it. It is kind of a pretty place. I'll say it now so I don't forget. The Jews have helped restore it. Well, there's some one hand washes the other in this event, because if the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is going to fall down, the tourists won't come. So, you know, they have a stake in it. But they did. They don't have enough money to do it, or don't spend enough money on it. So here's the courtyard. We'll walk in. And the church is, I'll give you some more pictures, but just to give you an idea, this cutaway is really nice. Because what you have here is the death of Christ is in this area. Now, remember, this is built on a spot that used to not have a building on it. I'll tell you the whole story. But so it isn't like they built this building on flat ground. They didn't build it on flat ground. They built a building around hills, all right? And some of the hills you can see. So this is where Christ was crucified, took down from the cross. And this is where they washed his body. And this is where they put him in the grave. And this is where he was resurrected. All right? And now beside this, we have a chapel here, like a church, a nave. The rotunda goes around this place where the Christ's burial, and we have first century burial chambers back in here that usually people don't go to, but you can go back in there. And then you go up, these are, by the way, upstairs, you walk, where am I here? Go in here, and you go back this way, you go upstairs, and then you on the second floor, and you can see there are two chapels up there, and you can see the spot where the cross was pushed into the ground and stuff like that, you know, like, yeah, whatever. So that's what that is, and you go further back, and there's some more chapels back there. They have a chapel for Helena, who supposedly found the place. All right, now a little bit of an idea what we got here. Here's the plan of it. Again, we walk in here, and a little disconcerting, he told me that I read that they said they were really working at to get a second exit out of it because they don't know for sure how the people would get out in case there was a fire. Well, I do it. I just, well, we one time we went up on the roof and came in this way on the roof and walked a hallway, came down this way and went down there. So I know there's got to be other ways out, but I thought, you know, that's kind of a strange thing. The place is packed with people. I mean, packed with people. So you don't want to have a fire there. All right, so here's where Christ was buried and resurrected. This is the place where he was crucified. This is the nave that now just acts as a church. And this is St. Helena's chapel. And these other places are not worth mentioning, I guess. All right, so that's the plan of it. Now, is this the right spot? Well, those of us that think a little bit, which should be all of us, I don't think so. One of the reasons is because it would have been inside the city wall, and you don't have the crucifixion inside the city. So it would have been a non-Jew, it would have been an anti-Jewish thing. So to make this the place, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, they assume that the wall made this jog, you know, to accommodate this fact. If you go to the model, you'll see that exactly how it did. The model goes, you know, it's almost like, you know, a pie with one quarter of it out. That's how it almost looks, like this. Well, here's your pie with a quarter of it out, because this is where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is, so it can't be in the city, so the wall goes here. Now, I might mention to you that you think, as I told you before, that when you go there, you find all this kind of stuff. We know everything. You know how much to know about the wall, where the walls were? I got a chart that shows it. I got a little piece here, a little piece there, a little piece there. You have no idea where the walls were. So they can move these walls around with impunity, and I think they can't do that because the likelihood of a city having a jog in a wall like this is almost zero, because the economy of a circle, obviously, is the most efficient. Efficiency has this long or the notch out of it. Doesn't make any sense. So anyway, that's the dispute about it, whether it's in the right place or not. And I think that's one reason, if not others, it's not in the right place. So this is what we do. The church, this is the crucifixion. It's outside the wall. With that jog, I showed that to you. And so here it shows, this is the wall that's there now, the 16th century wall. Not where it's supposed to be. It's really supposed to be down here like this. This guy gave his life for giving the wrong place. All right, so it still goes back to the idea they don't have the right place because the wall jogs. Now, short history. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre was started in about 326. It was the flagship church of the Byzantine Empire or Byzantine era. Remember, Byzantine means Christian. When Christians were in charge of the government. There always were Christians before that, but when they were in charge of the government, it becomes Byzantine, Byzantium. The church at Jerusalem look on the prestige of the Jewish temple, whose history the Church of the Holy Sepulchre intended to absorb. You know, I had this anti-Semitic idea in the early church, and this is just a part of it. They called the place where they were living Zion, you know, and against the Zion where it really was, the city of David. Now we know that the Christians suffered immensely under these two centuries, under 10 empire-wide crucifixions, persecutions. It doesn't mean that everybody everywhere is persecuted, but they were significant enough that the Christians were targeted by these emperors, and it went through 10 cycles. The last of these ended about 311, a little before. And when Diocletian was the perpetrator, by the way, you have lions and the Christians at the Colosseum in Rome that was built by the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Remember how that goes? So Constantine, now up and coming son of the emperor, Constantine, who had a mystical experience, he was coming up as a military power, dream, believed that the Christian God, I don't know whether I should capitalize this one or not, so I put it in quotes, could bring him victory over his brother-in-law, Maxentius. Maxentius was destroyed on the Milvian Bridge, the great sign. By this you shall conquer was the sign in the heavens, I guess. He is this cross. He assumed a Christian attitude and went on to conquer the rest of the Roman Empire so that by 324 it was all his. Now he absorbed Christianity, which seemed like a good thing because it spelled the end of persecution for the Christians. But Christianity faced a greater challenge to maintain moral and doctrinal purity under this soft regime. No one was asked to pay the ultimate price for their faith, because now anybody could be a believer and it would cost them nothing. So it was easier to be a Christian in Constantine's Rome, but harder to maintain a pure Christianity. And by the way, this is a distinction that was not lost on the church. And we talked about the Donatists came out in resistance to the church-led empire, empire-led church. The Christianized empire is called the Byzantine Empire because Constantine moved the capital to Byzantium, changed its name to Constantinople, and now it's called Istanbul. You know where it is, on the Bosphorus between the Black Sea and the Aegean Sea. I think that's the right name. Now back to Helena. This is the mother of Constantine. She may have been born again. I didn't restudy this again, but it seemed like, I remember years ago reading about her, she had the interest that would look like she might truly be born again. Constantine, her son, I doubt it. Her interest lay, and with her son's encouragement, apparently, because he paid her bills, her interest lay in identifying Christian sites before they were lost to the collective memory. So she made a trip to Jerusalem in her old age, probably 78, because she got home at 80, and I was encouraged because I will hit that mark this summer, and I'm going to go back to Israel, so it can be done. She made the trip to Jerusalem from probably, can't tell for sure, it could have been from Rome, but she was really from Asia Minor, Turkey. She made the trip to Jerusalem to find the place of the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus. Now, remember, we're 250 years after the event, so, you know, things are changing. She too had a mystical experience, dream, whatever, and visions of lightning strikes help her decide the place of the passion. And the church was built on that spot, and the church is known to us as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. She also identified the place of the birth of Jesus and had a church built in Bethlehem. So those are the two churches she had. She also had one built on the Mount of Ascension, but it has been destroyed. Okay, now, the location she picked is not likely authentic, and we went over this. If it is the correct one, the Jerusalem walls make an unexpected and undesirable break to accommodate it, which was required as a spot outside the city walls. So before we look at the present appearance, we need to know that there's a deal of change in the grade in the original site. Now, don't do that again. So we have this. Don't imagine the churches there. Just imagine these are the grades that existed when she was there in this little hill. All right, so that's what she saw besides her vision and said, this is the spot. There was a grave, there was a hill, and through her whatever desire to find the right spot, she chose this one, and it had a burial spot in it, okay? So what I'm pointing out to you is how that the grades now are all gone, because you walk into a building, it looks like everything's flat. But there used to be a grade there. And this is how it would have looked in the first go-around on this church. It would have had this rotunda, and it would have been the burial, an open courtyard, and then in this spot would have been the place where Christ would have been crucified, a little hill, and the church is built around it. This is the courtyard that's still there today. We walk in through this here door. Another picture of it. Calvary, Jesus' tomb, Jerusalem, outer city walls, little aerial perspective of it. Okay, got the idea? Of course. Tell me you do. Again, just the kind of idea that this is really outside. It wasn't inside a church. The church had been built on top of it, and so it started taking on this appearance. Okay. Now, the original church, 326, finished a couple of years, damaged and destroyed by fire in 614 by the Persians, not the Muslims. The Muslims protected the Christian sites, but a riot in 966 destroyed the doors and the roof, so it was really badly damaged. And a complete destruction was made there in 1009. Remember, crusade started in 1099, so it's before the crusade started. In fact, the destruction of the Church of Jerusalem was one of the impetuses for the crusades, you know, claim back the territory. So the church was rebuilt by 1048, and it pretty well appears as it is today from 1854, which you will see some of it. These buildings always look very unattractive to me. You can see they've been built at different times, different kinds of stone. You know, it doesn't seem like, like a camel put together by a committee, or a horse put together by a committee as a camel. So it's sort of like all these pieces, but over 1,000 years it has this look. And I'll talk about this later, but it's interesting that this little ladder has been there from 1852. So they can't agree who put it there, and they don't know who put it there. We don't know who should move it. So we have these squabbles that go on within the Christian community there. It's amazing. When you walk right into the church door, as I showed you, you walk into the spot and you see this wonderful, and it's beautiful, mosaic on the back wall. But in front of it is the slab of marble where it is said that Jesus' body was washed before it was buried. Because remember, to the right of me, your left, is where the crucifixion occurred. And to the left of me, your right, would be where the body was buried. So this is on that route. And people do all kinds of things. They bring rags from home, and they rub this thing, and they lay. And I don't want to make fun. I'm not making fun, but, I mean, it's sad to see the devotion to this. And there's nothing to it, this place, this stone. All right, so they wipe it and take it home, and, you know, they have something. I'm not into that stuff, so, but they are. They're like relics and stuff. So I got a picture of it, and you see they've been chipping off pieces of it to take home. Have it on their mantle and so forth. So, all right. So this is a picture from the angle I got. I'm looking this way, and the slab is right below here. No big deal here, but just gives you a little sense of the size of the building. And I don't know what you call them, the smoking urns, that's a word for it, are right over the slab. So they, to where, and this is where that... Yeah, is that what they call them?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. There's a tour guide losing his group. You see, he's trying to pull them back in. No, you see the number of people that are there. See, that not always that bad, but sometimes it is. And that's the place where you put your hand in your pocket with your wallet on your hand on your wallet in your pocket. Because wherever your money is, put your hand there. Now, these mosaics are gorgeous. I did a mosaic when I was in college. One mosaic is about this big. So I know what kind of work that goes into it. These are absolutely gorgeous. The only place I've seen that's been more gorgeous than St. Petersburg in Russia in a church. And it's just amazing what they can do with little tiles. Absolutely amazing. Now, this is an interesting mosaic because down here you see a skull. Well, that's supposed to be Adam's skull. Because, you know, they have this mythology about where, and they may be onto some of this. I don't want to agree with it, but I think that Jerusalem is the center of the world, and I think it is where God acts. And so they go so far as to say that's where Adam was created. So, well, you can do that with that, whatever you want. So his skull is down there, and it's below, somehow has to do with the crucifixion of Christ. Maybe he's the first Adam, he's the second Adam, I don't know. There are two columns, or a couple of columns that are left from the original, and I wondered if these were they, because these were them, these were they, because of the way they've been damaged here, you see? But I don't know for sure. I said, these are the things that were restored in the 1990s by the Jews to make the place viable, because they can't have it falling down. So in some ways, from an architectural standpoint, it's really gorgeous. It really is. So it's a rotunda over the place, and the burial of Jesus is the resurrection. Mike, you see, are you back there? There you are. Now, some of these are pictures that are not very good because I take them like, you know, and so... This is the nave, the chapel in the church where actually you would go, and if they had a sermon or something, yes, actually where you would sit, and the altar is what you're looking at. Really pretty. Okay, this is the burial spot. Now, of course, they built this building around this cave. We didn't go inside, and obviously you can see why. Everybody's lining up to go in there to do whatever they do in there. Just to say, I guess they've been there. Oh, the word is edicule. Edicule. That's a new word for me. That is the edicule. Is that how you'd say it? You people that know how to pronounce words? Sounds good? All right, so I've just gave you a number shots around it. And I have an idea that iron around it so it doesn't fall down. I really mean that, because these things get old and the mortar joints get dry and brittle, and you don't have the tomb of Jesus collapse, so I don't have that. A lot of candles, and they sell these, and you light them for purposes. And every once in a while, if they light these candles, and I'll show you a picture here, they lay them down like this, and it is smoke billows out, and wax smoke, and pretty soon everything's just dark, and it has to all be cleaned up again. And I see a priest come along with a squirt bottle, go, pick them up, start over. I don't know, it's okay, we don't do that stuff, but whatever. Good business and candles. And then people light them, and they light them, and they blow them out, and they take them home so they have souvenirs. God, these were burned at this place. So I understand the emotion that goes with it. I do. This is the second level, what I talked about, where Jesus was crucified. So we go up the stairs, and then we have two chapels up here. And these are not very good pictures because it's really dark, and so it's a little fuzzy. But you see two chapels, and I'll give you they're mosaics. Yep, they're mosaics. And I try to figure out what this is. I got another picture of it, but I don't know what it is. But it's part of this rock or part of the earth that was part of the cave. So this is Luke chapter something. I can't read the Greek. I didn't have time to look it up. So if you know what it is, tell me what it is. Now, compared to what you see at church, at the Church of the Nativity, this is much, much nicer. The Church of the Nativity is very depressing. It's very dirty and very dusty, and all the brass needs to be polished. You don't have that here. This is kept up. Now, I don't know who's keeping it up, because if the Catholic Church or these groups can't get together to keep it up, maybe it's funded by the Jews. I don't know. And this lady's on her knees, and there's a stone deck in here that they're doing something to it, touching it like they would downstairs. So we're at the place where he dies. This is where the cross was, and somehow the cross was stuck in this hole to hold it up. Yeah, but what this is, I don't know. It's a different thing. So here's that cross. So this is below it. Maybe there's. Oh, I know. There's a story that the blood of Jesus ran down from the body and ran into this crack, and it went down to Adam. Covered his sin, yeah. So, yeah. Rock of Calvary. Now this is taken down back from all lofty looking down. We're going to make it. Okay, then we have the stairs leading down to the St. Helena's Chapel, which is just because she's the one that discovered it, so she's been declared a saint. There's all kinds of stories about her, like she went to find the crosses, and she found the crosses, but there were three of them, and she didn't know which of the one was the cross that Jesus died on. So she devised a test that either a dead girl or woman was brought to these crosses, and the first cross didn't do anything for her. Second cross didn't do anything, but the one that Jesus died on was the one that made her alive again. So you have all these ideas that are mixed up into it that, we're so grateful to know that the Lord has communed to us in his word. And that was his final word, by the way. It was his final word. We don't need further confirmation. It's all there. Okay, today the Holy Sepulcher is in the hands of six Christian denominations, the Greek Orthodox, the Roman Catholic Church, the Armenian Apostolic, the Apostolic Church, the Syrian Orthodox Church of Antioch, where they're fighting these days. So when we talk about Christians in Syria, that's the kind we're talking about. The Coptics are the Christians in Egypt, and the Ethiopians are the Christians in Ethiopia. So those are the four groups, and there's no love lost between any of those groups. That is for sure. They're still arguing about that latter, remember, 1854. And there's a picture of the outside drawing of it, of the Holy Sepulchre. It looks a lot nicer in drawing than in real life. So what a glory. All right, I'll pray and let you go. Lord, thank you for the morning, for the evening together. Lord, again, for these places that have meant so much in history, and in these places where so much has happened in history that we marvel, and we have a small chance to stop and study and look back and try to figure out some of the things that happened there. Lord, we just thank you for the opportunity that we have with a sense of the scriptures to do this, and know, Lord, that we need no more information from you than we already have in scripture for things that relate to our life and to our godliness and for how salvation is obtained. But again, Lord, we're students of the world, students of what you've done, and every bit of it is a glory to you, and we enjoy stopping to look at it and study it for its benefits. Thank you, Lord, for these weeks together as a class and for blessing us so much with salvation that's so free and offered freely to all who just believe in him for their, then believe in you for their salvation. Thank you, Lord, for when that happens, we're born again into a new life, and that life is eternal, and it will be, as we've said, with you for eternity. Keep us safe as we go, and bring us again back next week, and pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen.